Okay. I'm very pleased to be chairing this lecture, which is in our series of Global Civil Society lectures, which follow on from the Global Civil Society Yearbook. And today, Helma Danhaier and Hagai Katz are going to be talking about their chapter on global connectedness. Helma Danhaier is a professor of public policy and social welfare at the University of California, UCLA, and also director of the Center for Civil Society there. And he is a centennial professor at the London School of Economics. And before being a founder member, I think, of the Center for Civil Society at the UCLA, he was director of the Center for Civil Society at LSE. He has been one of the earliest and most prolific researchers in nonprofit research, and particularly having brought a quantitative approach to nonprofit research that was quite new to the subject. And he's been very important in that sense as one of the editors of the Global Civil Society Yearbook, always bringing that input of the empirical tradition to global civil society. Hagai Katz has been an invaluable resource in the last few years, actually putting together the record section, the quantitative section at the back of the Global Civil Society Yearbook, I think for 3 years running now. He is also focused on quantitative research on international NGOs in particular. He is more or less going to be the main act today, whereas I understand Helmut is going to be the warm-up act. Hagai is a lecturer at the School of Management at Ben-Gurion University and a research associate at the Israeli Center for Third Sector Research, as well as still associated with UCLA as well. And what they've been trying to research, and the question they've asked themselves is, global civil society is often portrayed, is put forward, as a public force that kind of opposes inequality and injustice. And Helma Danhaier and Hagai Katz have looked at the most prominent actors in global civil society, international, transnational NGOs, and the way they are connected in order to ask two basic questions about this idea of global civil society as a force opposing inequality and injustice. The first is, how powerful can they really be? And they're asking this through the lens of how well connected are international NGOs with each other. We're told that we live in a network age. How networked are NGOs, and how does that make them powerful or not? And the other question that goes even deeper is the way that they are connected to each other more equal and more just than the way that transnational corporations or states connect with each other? Is there something particularly about international NGOs networks that makes them a counterpower? I think Helmut will be talking for about 15 minutes and Hagai for 30 minutes, so that then still leaves us the other half of the time, 45 minutes, for questions before closing off at 8 o'clock. So, Helmut.
Yeah. Thank you. And good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure being here, and I'm very pleased to see many old colleagues and friends in the audience. It is perhaps a bit unusual to give 1.5 presentations and have almost a double act, but there is a reason for it, and I want to spend the next couple of minutes telling you why we decided to have a preview of some of the larger work we're doing before we then look at that specific problem of NGO connectedness in the context of Gramscian theory, as Marlis briefly outlined. And I want to begin by a few more general remarks about a study in global connectedness, because there is more than just one particular paper or one particular book you can write about it. Behind it, and that's the sense I want to carry across to you, behind it is a full research agenda that is just beginning to gather momentum. And you need to put that paper that you will see presented today in the context of the yearbook. And what you see on that slide are some of the major objectives that the yearbook tries to achieve. And in particular, I want to point your attention to the second to the last of the bullet points there, that we look for new forms. Is there something new emerging in this field we call global civil society? What is new out there? And very, very soon, when you start reading the globalization literature and when you start looking at the literature about global civil society, that concept of connectedness comes up. And it comes up at both the theoretical and the methodological levels. And it has, I think, an import that goes beyond studying the aspect of global civil society. Something about the way we see, or at least Hagai and I see, the social sciences developing, with a greater emphasis on structural aspects, on the combinatorial flavor that our that social life has. And the structure of globalization, and with it the structure of civil society, does indeed have very much of this combinatorial flavor to it. It rests much less on pre-established geographical units, but on the connection of entities that are separate in space. And think about production and distribution chains. Think about the way movements are mobilized, and think about web-based forms of organizing. It's a very, very different way of finding a form for the phenomenon that we want to study. The key concept of global connectedness certainly has to do with time-space compression. There's a greater frequency. We imply greater density of these connections, and the volume of connections has increased. And that involves individuals as well as network interactions, that different networks begin to interact. It involves organizations and institutions. And very soon you begin to see that these global connections create a very complex, very multifaceted web that has potential global reach. And much of what we are about in the Global Civil Society Yearbook and in the methodological work Hagai and I are doing is coming to terms with that very complex, multifaceted concept. Here are some of the typical findings we have come up with and that you see reflected in the pages of the yearbook. And let me just insert a methodological note. And I know there is an ongoing discussion here at the school about methodological nationalism. Much has been written about it, but we are less concerned in diagnosing the problem in our work, which is that too often the nation state is the unit of analysis, when in fact it should be something else. And when you study globalization, the nation state is probably the least central of the forms you may want to look at. And we're less concerned in diagnosing the problem, what happens if we live in a world, as we do, where the basic machinery of social, economic, and political statistics is also geared towards the nation state as the main customer. I think we're primarily, in the yearbook, looking at how we can overcome these problems. And one of the problems is the aggregation problem, it's the coverage problem, and data availability problems. Right? So I want you to appreciate that we have this very, very complex network of social phenomenon coming out of the greater connectivity as part of globalization, and we have a methodological problem that I've just outlined around methodological nationalism. So in overcoming that problem, we are looking for more appropriate units of analysis other than the nation state. We are trying to engage different social science methods, in particular relational approaches such as network analysis, but not exclusively. And we have an eye out for what are theoretically very rich theorems or propositions that have been proposed, such as the one that we'll hear about in a moment from Hagai, looking at Gramscian theory and how we can test Gramscian theory using a network approach. And what are some of the policy implications that follow from our work? That too resonates in the presentation you are about to hear. So you could say that we're trying to achieve quite a bit, and you then will be the judge in about 45 minutes' time whether we have made progress in addressing a methodological issue around a key concept, and if we want to be theoretically as well as policy relevant. In the Global Civil Society Yearbook, which is now entering its sixth year, we have looked at these issues through the lens of different methodologies. And we looked at GIS, to what extent can geographic information systems help us understand aspects of global connectedness. Very big is, of course, network analysis. It's perhaps the quintessential tool you want to use if you study connections, because connections are relations, and network analysis is about studying, analyzing relations. We looked at other methods that you are seeing here, but much of what you will do tonight is about, it's an application of network analytic approaches to Gramscian theory. We developed a whole system of indicators, and when you look at these indicators, you won't have much time to look at it, in fact, but just a sense, it says movements, it talks about networks, it talks about participation, about activists. It has very much the flavor of connections in it. Here are some attempts where we try to map aspects of connectivity or approaching it. Right? This is a measure of the density of NGO distributions around the world. The readers of the yearbook will probably be familiar with this because we used that in a previous edition of it. This is another way of looking at economic globalization. There's a lot of connectivity here because trade involves a connection. Some part is trading in the world is trading with another part. The same way with direct foreign investment. That also implies a flow, in this case, the flow of finances from one entity to another. This is the flow of refugees. This is an organizational map of a large international organization, Friends of the Earth. That too, you see, implies a structure, implies a relationship between different elements of that organization, between headquarters and affiliates and membership organizations, committees. Right? This is one of the first maps that Haggai drew. These are also membership structures of different kinds of organizations that we find in the global civil society arena here at the Climate Action Network. This is a mobilization happens, and much of this happens also through some form of connection. This was the mobilization effect in February 2003 against the war of Iraq. Much of that was done through a web-based forms of mobilization. There was not one centralized structure here organizing it. And this is an issue network where we try to identify, and you get a nicer solution of the same network. What you have here, this is an ordered arrangement of it. What do NGOs actually talk about at a social forum? And what is the, you might say, the structure of the debate? How do NGOs relate to topics related to policy issues? Right? So the key concept of global connectedness. So many cells in that table I showed you before, in that matrix that increasingly guides our yearbook network, rotate around the notion of connectedness. And I think they demonstrate the centrality of it. How do we approach it methodologically? Right? How do we get a sense of this connectedness into some social science methodology and way of analysis and still come out being able to handle the complexity of the phenomenon that we are concerned in? Why is that important? And that's the last slide I show you, and then I hand it over to Haggai. And I think if we are in a position to take social science methodologies, such as network analysis, structural approaches, and apply them to units of analysis other than the nation state, right? If we are successful in doing that, then we have a very good way of trying to get at the emerging and potential properties of the structure of a more global world. In that way, we, in fact, have the opportunity to overcome the limitations of methodological nationalism. And we can anticipate what the shape of communities and the configurations of these communities will be across space, in non-contiguous space. And ultimately, since I spend most of my time working at a policy school, we always wonder, what are the implications for the kinds of policy dialogues, debates, and policy making we will get that are shaped by this very complex network of increasing global connectedness. So with that, let me turn it over to Haggai.
Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to see so many of you here. The title of the study that on which the chapter in the Global Civil Society Yearbook was based, but the study went a little further in the analysis is this, and you can all read it. And it is trying to take this concept of global connectedness and the methodology of network analysis and to apply it to test one of the major theories on civil society that has been also, let's say, adapted to the global civil society arena by some later writers. And this is Gramsci's conceptions of civil society. And in Gramsci's prison notebooks, he has this very haphazard and mixed up discussion of what civil society is and what is its relationship to hegemony. And usually it is considered correct to argue that Gramsci saw civil society as both at the same time a site where hegemonic institutions utilize, co-opt those organizations and utilize them to silence real resistance and to disseminate the values, the hegemonic values. While at the same time, civil society is seen by Gramsci as the site where real resistance can emerge. And as Persaud said when he was analyzing his own country, Jamaica, we can see hegemony and counter-hegemony, or the role of civil society in vis-a-vis hegemonic domination as a simultaneous double movement. And the question here, oh, one more step. So one of the problems with Gramsci's applying Gramsci's work to global civil society is that Gramsci was interested in the civil society in the national level, and it was applied later on in the early 80s by Robert Cox to international relations, arguing that the same ideas can be used also in a global context in which hegemony is not one state that is hegemonic, but rather a system of states and institutions that are sharing a hegemonic agenda and are holding most of the, let's say, foci of power. And I would argue that their main, the creed of this hegemonic model is neoliberal capitalism or neoliberal globalization. Now, if we take Gramsci's theoretical model and break it down into those two different angles, we get to two sort of conflicting models. The first one is a hegemonic models, in which there is a historic block, historic in terms of it happened at a certain point of time. It's a configuration that is the result of certain circumstances, historical circumstances. And there has been a dominant historic block of capitalist elites, which has in it some dominant states as well as corporate elites. Those elites enforce this capitalist neoliberal ideology through many means, through the media, through public policy, through, some would say, through some NGOs as well. And the use, co-optation is, or what Gramsci called transformismo, as a way to utilize civil society to assist them in enforcing and disseminating this ideology. On the other hand, the counter-hegemonic model, which looks at civil society as where the development of a counter-hegemonic historic bloc can appear. This historic bloc will be a coalition of groups which don't have to have the same agenda. And that's why they're often called something like multiplicity of antagonisms. It's a diverse group of organizations that will form a global movement of sorts that will be able to put some kind of a viable counterforce to the force of those dominant elites, those capitalist elites, in the systems of global governance by adopting some kind of a reformist ideology and engaging in what is called a war of position, a gradual process of trying to transform society and bring in the reformist agenda into the global governance institutions, into the global governance discourse. And the question that I wanted to test was, if we look at global civil society now, the way, and mostly at the structure of global civil society, and the connections between organizations, which one of those models do we find in the field? If you look at how organizations, what organizations are connected, what is the structure of those connections, which of those models is supported, and what are the implications of those models? Now, when you try to measure that, you need to make a step, kind of a leap, between the theoretical conceptions of Gramsci and neo-Gramscian thinkers and network methodology and network concepts. And actually, it is quite easy to do that, because especially the main concept that was, you've seen it come reappear in a few slides, the historic block is, in its essence, has a very networky logic to it. It talks about many groups connecting together, creating some kind of a coalition, in which all kinds of interests are brought together, and creating some kind of a whole that's more than the sum of its elements. And this and the concept is very easily very easily translatable. And when you look at the different predictions on what this network, this network of global civil society organizations would look like under the two opposing models, we can reach different, very, whoo, damn, I need water. Sorry. I'm a little excited in face of this very distinguished crowd. Flattery never hurt anybody. Okay. So we have two sets of predictions that emerge from applying this network logic to the different Gramscian models. The first one is the hegemonic model, in which we expect this network of global civil society, if global civil society is a tool in the hands of those capitalist elites, if it is completely co-opted and it doesn't serve any counter-hegemonic purpose whatsoever, would find it very much mimicking the logic and the disparities of those of the capitalist world system, in which we would find wide north-south disparities and a very strong core-periphery structure, in which the core is in the north and the periphery, the south is in the periphery. Would find a very unequal distribution of ties with international governmental organizations, which are seen as actors of the neoliberal capitalist elite, which use and engage with NGOs in a strategic manner to use them to disseminate the ideological and the neoliberal ideology, their ideological agenda, to the NGOs constituencies. And we would find a very fragmented network, because this is the interest of the capitalist elites, to fragment global civil society so it doesn't create a global movement that can be a viable counterforce. On the other hand, if global civil society, as it is now, is, let's say, starting to develop or actually becoming a counter-hegemonic developing counter-hegemonic historic bloc, or at least developing the becoming, let's say, some kind of an infrastructure on which such a bloc can emerge, we expect to find a very inclusive network. By definition, the historic bloc is inclusive. A historic bloc, as defined by Gramsci, is a combination of all the subaltern groups. So if it's not, doesn't have all the subaltern groups, it's not a historic bloc. It's not a counter-hegemonic historic bloc. So it will have to be inclusive, in which we would expect to find a fully global presence. So this network should reach everywhere, should be everywhere in the world. And it shouldn't cluster. There shouldn't be major differences with how dense those links are in different regions of the world. It should be very dense, which means that there are a lot of links between different groups and different interests and different constituencies. It should be equally distributed across different groups, different interests, different constituencies. Those links with international governmental organizations shouldn't be reflect any kind of strategic manipulation by capitalist elites, and it should be very well integrated, which means that we will expect to find dominance of intergroup and not intra-group links. So kind of bridging rather than bonding ties between organizations. Now, the data came from an organization in Brussels called the Union of International Associations that has been collecting information on NGOs, on international NGOs, since 1910. And they have a wonderful database, but don't start with me on how they handle it and how they share it with the public. They don't. But they did. We've been collaborating with them for a few years, in the first 3 years, 4 years of the yearbook, and they agreed to provide an actual raw data, a section of the raw data, which included, at the end, 10,001 international NGOs, in which what I got from them was a matrix of links by which every link that was reported in their database, each organization has a profile, and that profile reports of other organizations that it has links with. For example, I am a member of this organization, I get funding from that organization, or I do collaborative work with the other organization. Those links enabled me to create a square matrix of 10,001 by 10,001 in which organization A has a link with organization D and organization E doesn't have a link with organization F. I got some descriptive information on those organizations, and I also added a few other networks, regretfully not with such detailed data, but rather with country networks of international NGOs that I created from this connectivity matrix of trade and of interstate relationships by form of embassy and consular exchanges. And then I went through a whole list of analyzers. Most of them are network analyses, but also some spatial analyses using geographic information systems, which I think network and geographic information systems are not linked enough in the in social science. And the findings can be the findings were contradictory, actually. They supported both of the models partially. None of the models was fully supported, none of the models was fully rejected. One of the first point, definitely a strong bias towards northern NGOs. There's so many more of them, they have more links, they are almost all of the network. You're gonna see the numbers in a minute. The network is extremely sparse. It's even sparser than interstate relationships. It's sparser than the global trade network. It's extremely sparse. Actually, I'll tell you how sparse it is. 3 out of 10,000 possible links. So out of 10,000 possible links between organizations in my matrix, only 3 actually exist. Now, mind you, these are only inter-organizational links, only formal inter-organizational links, and if a member of the board of this organization met with the CEO of that organization in Davos, I don't have information on that. These are formal inter-organizational relationships. This network is extremely unequal, and it's got a pronounced core, semi-periphery, periphery structure that is far more polarized than that of those capitalist dominant networks of interstate relations and capitalism. You can see, if we look at the top 20 countries in terms of how many NGOs in that network reside in those countries and how many links the organizations in each country has with other NGOs, the top 20 countries cover about 80% of this network. And if you look at the list, almost all of them are in the north. And of course, the US, the UK, and Belgium, or even to be a little bit more specific, New York, DC, London, and Brussels. That's where global civil society is to, what, 50%? So 40%. 40% of the global civil society network is in 4 cities. You can see that when you look at the spatial distribution of those, of the links. So this is a density map of the links between NGOs, and the links are there. New York, Toronto, London, and Paris, Brussels, Amsterdam. And you can find a few emerging kind of secondary foci in the south, but they are definitely marginal. Looking at the density, when I compare the density between the country matrices, so how NGOs connect, how are countries linked by NGOs, and how are countries linked by embassies, and how are countries linked by trade, the differences are substantial. The density of the country by NGO links matrix is 7%, so 7 out of every 100 possible links between countries exist. Well, for trade, 40 out of every 100 possible links, and for embassies, 14 out of almost 15 out of every possible links exist. So the network of global civil society is definitely not even remotely as dense as that of the dominant elites. Also, a core periphery structure, this is the NGO network. And those show the different structures, the different clusters. And this is the organizations that are at the core, these are organizations that are at the semi-periphery, and these are the organizations, NGOs, or actually these are countries by NGOs, that are at the periphery. And we can see that all 3 of those networks, NGOs, trade, and embassies, show a distinct breakdown into core, periphery, and semi-periphery. But the NGO one there's much greater distance between the core, the semi-periphery, and the periphery. And the core is much smaller. You can see the number of countries included in the core by way of NGO links is much smaller. So there is a smaller core, and I can tell you from further analysis that I did that core consists mainly of northern countries, actually solely of northern countries. More findings. This network is extremely autocorrelated. Central organizations link with other central organizations. Although I expected links with the intergovernmental organizations to have some kind of a pattern, it actually was absolutely random. And finally, there was a very strong and cohesive, well-integrated structure. So it's not dense, but everybody is connected with everybody. There's nobody is excluded. And you can't, this network is not fragmented. And this looks at the integration of the network. This is a 3D diagram of a correspondence analysis of links, in which organizations that are linked with each other are get grouped together in the diagram. And what we see here are four major clusters. Where the first one, this one, includes 93% of the organizations. So, and it doesn't look that big because the dots are plotted one on top of the other, because a lot of organizations have almost identical patterns of links with each other. And we have a few other small clusters, but the main point here is that there is, if the question is global civil society fragmented into kind of disparate subnetworks that are only loosely connected, it's not. It's one network. It's not well represented in the South, we saw, but it's still one network, and everybody is well connected with everybody. And those connections cross regions and income and religion and language. So we have a very heterogeneous, very well integrated network. And this chart is very colorful, I know. What it does is this: each symbol here is a country. And the colors reflect the regions, and the shapes reflect the income level, GDP per capita. The size of the dots is how central those dots are in the network. And what we can see, actually, what is important in here is that the network analysis software that I use to do this tries to draw the network, so it's called the spring diagram. It imagines the network as if the nodes are connected with springs. And the tension of the springs is determined by how strong the links between each node is, between each two nodes is. So it is an algorithm that it's really nice to saw it drawing. It goes crazy for a while, and then it starts to settle. And it finds a balance where it draws the most central and closer links together. So it tries to optimize the network structure, and in this case I also imposed on it a cluster analysis based on region. And you can see the squares are the regions. And actually, if there was a breakdown of this network by region, we would find those squares completely not overlapping and the different colors clustered together. If there was any clustering by or breakdown, the fragmentation of this network by income level, we would find the triangles here, the squares here, the diamonds there. But we don't. What we find is a network that is completely bridging between regions, between organizations of different income levels, and also between organizations that deal with different issues, organizations that deal with development, organizations that deal with education, and organizations that deal with the environment, they're all interlinked. Now, if we sum up all of those findings, and we look at the predictions of the hegemonic and the counter-hegemonic model on the different network features that I expected that I was looking into, we can find that the findings support both models partially, as I said, and there you can't really point to one of them that is absolutely dominant. When you come to think about it, in terms of Gramsci's theory, the conclusion that I reached was that we can argue that global civil societies is in a transitional state. It's in the midst of this long-term process of developing a counter-hegemonic historic bloc from this infrastructure. Okay, this global network of international organizations is the infrastructure from which a global movement will emerge. And it's getting there. Or perhaps it's actually in the complete opposite direction, where this global civil society is gradually being co-opted by those hegemonic elites, by dominant, by the IMF, by the World Bank, through collaboration, through funding, through all kinds of mechanisms that are used for domination, and it's gradually gonna become completely fragmented, completely unequal, and completely co-opted by this hegemonic world system. Another thought about this goes again to this simultaneous double movements argument that I brought before. The attempt to break down Gramsci's theory into two separate models doesn't work. Why? Because in its essence, it's a dialectic argument. It's not two different models. It's one model that argues that civil society or global civil society has a dialectic role in this relationship between hegemony and counter-hegemony. And the attempt to break it down into two separate arguments was futile. Now, what does the data, what do those findings mean in terms of policy? And as Helmut said, the Center for Civil Society at UCLA is in the School of Public Affairs, so policy is what we do. The questions are, when you look at this network, what does it mean for global governance? What does it mean for the role of global civil society in global governance? If you look on the bright side, this very integrated structure that we found is a good sign. We have a very cohesive and holistic actor. Okay, it represents all constituencies. It represents all interests. It deals with all the issues. Okay, nobody's marginalized. So this global civil society, so to speak, this structure, this network of organizations, is definitely very cohesive, very well integrated, and definitely somebody that can handle this jurisdictional gap that David Held mentions in the global governance system, there's nobody who wants to deal with all those issues together. There's no holistic actors that are addressing all the global governance issues, and a lot of issues are falling between the seats or falling between the cracks. But on a less optimistic note, the findings show that the network is extremely sparse. So how effective can it be if it's so sparse? How effective can it be as an infrastructure for the growth of a global movement if it's so sparse? It also has a limited global reach. So how can it be representative of marginalized constituencies, for example, in Africa? Remember the map. Africa was all white. There was nothing there. There was a little black spot in Nairobi, a little black spot in Cairo, a little black spot in Johannesburg, and that's it. So do the peoples of Africa or the peoples of Central Asia have a voice in global governance through this network of international NGOs? Do those international NGOs speak in their voice if they're not even there? What can be done? The first is really working strategically, proactively on enhancing the links within this network. There are a lot of organizations, there aren't a lot of links between them. As we saw, I had 10,000 in one organization, I had 30,000 links. When if you double 10,000 by 10,000, you get 100 million possible links. Of 100 million possible links, we have 30,000. That's lousy. That's very low. So we need to, and NGOs, northern NGOs in particular, need to deliberately try to find counterparts in the south to work with. Donors should encourage this kind of coalition building, this kind of networking. The World Bank should encourage it, UN agencies, OECD countries, USAID, EuropeAid, they all should encourage this when they consider funding NGOs that provide services or develop all kinds of projects. NGOs should open themselves to southern constituencies by one of the interesting techniques to do that is to turn the General Assembly of the NGO to an international conference in which scholarships can pay for southern interested parties to come and participate in those meetings. And of course, building the capacity of those southern NGOs to hook into this network, because perhaps they want to be, people want to hook them in, but they don't have the know-how, the organizational know-how, the political know-how, how to do that. Another aspect is, we saw that one of the main problems of this network is that it's not enough organizations in the South. And we need to enhance that and help by either helping local NGOs go global, go international, so turn NGOs into INGOs, and for northern NGOs to create local chapters. But we, as scholars, have another role in here beyond those policy recommendations were for those global actors. We, as scholars, as students, need to work on developing the knowledge, making those network structures known, making the flaws in those networks known, making the possible benefits of those networks known so that people have an incentive to develop them. Studying what are the consequences, looking at how we can turn organizations, local organizations, help them go global. This is our task. Thanks.
Thank you, Helmut and Haggai, for a very dense and solid piece of work that leads to, I would say, sophisticated, balanced, and somewhat contradictory outcomes, and then even going a step further and trying to work through both the policy and the academic implications of this. I would like to start taking questions, I would say two or three at a time. I would like to ask everyone, if you feel you're in a rush, to either leave now or stick it out until 8 o'clock. We will end 8 o'clock on the dot, so we don't have the disruption of people kind of gradually hemorrhaging as we carry on. So if you wish to leave, leave now. I'd like to remind you that the question is one of those things that starts with one sentence and ends with your voice inflection rising. If you feel you need to have three sentences, that's fine as well, but don't try and do another lecture. So I think this one was a hard act to follow. Why don't you start? Yeah. There's a microphone coming your way. Please tell us who you are as well.
I have two questions, and excuse me if my language is a little bad, but as the first speaker has said that we are very best in analysis, but we are very, very short in terms of when it comes to, pardon me?
Please speak into the microphone more. I think your language is fine, but it needs to be louder.
No, in terms of language, I mean to say that the first speaker had said very clearly that we are very good in terms of analysis, but when it comes to the actions, somehow I feel that the lecturer has failed us. So excuse me for a very, very frank comment. My first question is about there was one in the last slide that you said that one has to distinguish between the reformist and conservative organizations. Traditionally, if we see most of these international NGOs and their national or local networks, they have worked on secular agendas, and that necessarily means that they have left a lot of cultural issues, a lot of religion-related issues, and a lot of nationality-related issues aside. And somewhere, a lot of networks that are emerging today, they are tending to fill in that kind of gaps. So when you look at the networks, particularly at national level, you will find that both kind of organizations, international organizations and their chapters, working on one agenda, and also at the same time co-opting or trying to work with the so-called conservatives organizations. And this was, I think, was very, very clear during WSF, if you look at that as a network, emerging network rather. That's one. Second thing is when we talk about the global governance or emerging global society and what's the aim of it. I mean, it's still not very clear what is the role of this emerging global society. Is it largely a service delivery, or is it largely creating kind of political awareness and mobilizing people around those kind of political goals? I think till the time we do not clarify on that particular point, the entire coalition agenda and co-optation agenda will go on, and the dominance of the northern NGOs will remain. So I would like to have clarification on both these points. Thank you.
Okay, now amazingly, I don't see any other burning questions right now. Okay, I'll take the lady in the pink shirt and Anna up front.
Thank you. I'm Michelle Bellers. I want to answer that question, which is really bad. Because it seems to me that one of the points of global civil society is to challenge neoliberal ideological hegemony. And I wanted to ask whether you thought that the pervasiveness of that ideology itself was an opportunity for future connections between NGOs in different countries. I believe that when the multilateral agreement on investment was put forward, which was a very pernicious document, that led to the largest cooperation between NGOs that had been seen up till then. And I wondered whether your data set went back to that period or not.
And then I'll take one more question up here.
Anna Stavronakis. I have what might be a definitional question about, for example, is a local branch of, say, Oxfam in, I don't know, the Philippines, does that count as a southern or a northern organisation if you're looking at organisations that started in the global north but have since spread to the global south? Or does it depend on the organisation, or is there a definitional issue? Because when you ask about, you recommend that NGOs become INGOs, what process are you just seeing the spread of particular types of activity, or, you know, who are you looking for in the global south?
Do you want to start?
I think there's some questions specifically to address to our guy, and I'll let you handle those, particularly the last one and the previous one. So let me say something about your comment first. I think there's a very, very clear message that comes out of the work that we've been doing. And it's a very simple message, too. And the nice aspect of being kind of a research and methodologist is that there's so much in network analysis that says, yes, that's the way it should be. And that's that connectivity matters. And the networks that Haggai has been, the network structure Haggai has been able to identify tells us we simply need more of them. There is not a basically inherent friction in a network. They're not fundamental cleavage structures. We just need more connections. We need more ties. And that is supported by a basic theory in social network analysis that goes back to the mathematician Erdős, who I think nearly three decades ago wrote a very fascinating paper where he said that if you take a very large set of unconnected points or dots and you randomly keep throwing connections, but you randomly then connect various dots, like some of us do when we're in a boring lecture. You start putting dots and try to connect it. For a long period of time, it will be a fragmented structure. It will have several points connected there, several points connected there, but when you increase the density, right, you get a certain threshold effect. And at the moment, global civil society is a long way away from that threshold effect, but what we don't observe are the elements of what could develop into a highly, in a segmented, fragmented system. So it is inclusive, but too sparse to be a forceful actor at the same time. When it comes to the functions, very briefly, what is such global civil society supposed to do? We basically know the answer. There are three activities or three roles, of which service delivery is one, advocacy, giving voice is a second, and accountability is a third. The difficulty or the tension is that the three of them sometimes don't coalesce very nicely, that one comes at the expense of the other. So that's why we get certain tendencies in global civil society than over others. And some actors, like the World Bank, focus one over the other. But we know we have a governance problem globally, and we know that we have institutions trying to address it.
The reformist conservative distinction is definitely a problem, a flaw, a limitation in the study. The data that exists today and the data that we had access to does not allow us to draw this distinction. We could not operationalize it and draw this distinction. So our data doesn't distinguish that. Now, I would love to be able to distinguish and to see whether what role different organizations with different ideologies play. Now, it's going to be very difficult to distinguish because some organizations, in many organizations, it is not really clear if they're reformist or not. And sometimes they're reformist on one issue and conservative on another one. Okay, you can take very religious organizations that are definitely very conservative on some issues. They're really involved in poverty alleviation with a very, very broad human rights, social rights kind of approach. To the defense of this analysis, notwithstanding the fact that it did not distinguish between reformists and non-reformists, I would quote Robert Putnam, who said that when social capital is developed, it doesn't really matter what the organizations are doing. What matters are the links. The links facilitate interaction, they facilitate collaboration, they facilitate the flow of ideas, and they facilitate a sense of community, which global civil society is lacking. So, reformist or not, they're working with each other, they're collaborating, they are creating an infrastructure, a disconnectedness. It's beyond what each organization is doing. It's this connectedness that is the infrastructure from which a movement can grow. So some of those organizations will not join the movement, but the movement can emerge if this kind of turning point that Helmut pointed to will appear in terms of the density and the structure of the network. Now the structure of the network, this well-integrated network, can allow for this turning point to arrive, because the basic structure of the network is good, it's just not developed. As to the role of global civil society, I don't want to add anything to what Helmut said, I think he covered it. I just want to say that in this analysis, because it is about what is the role of global civil society vis-a-vis global hegemony of neoliberal capitalism, it's actually introducing an alternative, or taming neoliberal globalization. And I agree with you that the pervasiveness of this neoliberal agenda, this neoliberal creed, is very important. And it's important in this context because it creates a frame. It frames, it's actually, I don't remember who said it, they said it's a frame of frames. So it's a double frame, it's a triple frame that enables to put under the same roof a lot of other frames about gender, about environment, about poverty, and you have kind of an umbrella frame that allows to take all those different interests and create a historic block, a counter-hegemonic historic block. As to the question of local chapters, two parts of my answer. One, in my data, local chapters are not counted, only the headquarters of the organization. So Oxfam India was not counted. Oxfam South Africa was not counted. Okay, just Oxfam. As to the what I said about creating local chapters as a remedial action, I think it is a problematic idea. It is a problematic suggestion, because it has been argued, and remember Rajesh Tandon, one of the prominent global civil society leaders in the South, in a visit at the UCLA, said to us, the problem with those local chapters is that they are well connected through their headquarters with the corridors of power, with those big donors, with those big foundations. And when Friends of the Earth comes and makes a Friends of the Earth India or a Friends of the Earth Bangladesh, they drain the resources from all the local organizations. So I would like to take it back a little bit and say, yes, Friends of the Earth, Oxfam, all of those northern, big, strong, well-connected organizations that have access to all those important and influential people in the global governance system should go global and get local and create local chapters. But those local chapters shouldn't, let's say, should be created in collaboration with local NGOs and should be rooted in the local community and not be implants.
Okay, that's one question, that's another. And you get a very brief right of come back at the very end. So if we begin with Cynthia.
Right, this is sort of a follow-on to what you just said. So if you're trying to get the big international northern-based IGOs to become more global, to partner, A, how are you going to incentivize them? People like to be in control, they like to be in charge. How are you going to push that? And if you're going to push it from the north side, how does that not propagate sort of the continuance of this reform being led from the north and then still continuing to be north dominated?
I have a related question to the domination or a conceptual question somehow. You mentioned social capital, and I was wondering in how far this is a contradiction itself, because using a concept which is there to measure something social, to make it, to operationalize it again, is the whole idea of measuring density of these networks. Doesn't that somehow imply the idea of dominion again and of hegemony? Because here and somehow implying what is more than the other. For example, here is more social capital as there. This in somehow is a hegemonic term again.
I definitely agree with the fact that you said you need more connectedness, but I think maybe the question is that the places where you need the more connectedness in the southern-based NGOs are the places that have the environments that are least supportive of these groups. So in that sense, the nation-state might be the, you know, most important unit of analysis. So how do you believe is the best approach to, I guess, lobby these nation states through a more realistic or a realist perspective, or something akin to like the boomerang effect or something more progressive like that?
A brief right of return for the lady behind.
Just quickly, the thing with citing Friends of the Earth as an example, Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace are my special areas of research. And Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth connect their global network very differently, because Friends of the Earth is very bottom up, and it is often in the south from indigenous groups that go forward, and they all have different names and they all have local group structures, whereas Greenpeace is very top down. But I just wanted to say something about the costs of connectivity, depending on how it's done, in that if you're calling for international conferences, if you're in areas that are very resource poor, that's an extremely expensive way of doing things, as opposed to connections of ideas through information technologies, and whether you thought that was an issue. And lastly, if the idea is to hook southern NGOs into a network, isn't there a problem if there's a risk that that network is part of a global co-option program? Because it all depends which way you look at the network.
And I will just add one question of my own to it, which actually steps back from all these policy questions to your methodology. I was struck and surprised that you quoted Robert Putnam to say it doesn't matter what exactly the organisations do, as long as they're connected to each other, it has an impact, it has an effect. Because that rather seems to contradict your having chosen Gramsci as your kind of leading light. Because it seems to me that Gramsci is all about, when you talk about manufacturing consent as well as challenging consent, it's all about in the realm of ideas. So my question really is, if you are looking at connectivity of NGOs and you're not distinguishing whether it's the Rotary Club or the Global Landless Movement, is Gramsci the best tool to be looking at what you're looking at? Is hegemony and counter-hegemony and the right way of looking at NGO networks, I guess, for both of you?
Let me take a first crack at that, because I have the easier position here. I did not mention Putnam.
Actually, when I mentioned Putnam, I was waiting for you to jump and say something about it.
Yeah, I think what our guy did is use the best data available, and unfortunately those data did not allow him to draw any distinctions about what kind of ideology is being pursued by these NGOs, whether they are in line with hegemonic or counter-hegemonic argument. But I think the structural finding is still very, very important, even if you take that qualification in, namely that we have a infrastructure in place. And depending on what values, now assuming there would be counter-hegemonic values, that structure would allow to play out. It would, in fact, come closer to being a counter-hegemonic force, even not knowing what the values are. But if they were there, we would see it more. The problem being that we don't have enough of that structure. And there was one other term. The gentleman there about the nation-state being the unit of analysis. Now, it's not a unit of analysis. I agree with you, but it's not a unit of analysis. It's where you become active. Definitely, you want to change the... The World Bank now calls it, they have a very lovely term for it, called the enable environment for civic engagement. See, that's what they're trying to put in place. That necessarily has to take place at the level of the nation state. So I agree with you. But still, from a conceptual perspective, the outcome of that enable environment once put in place for global civil society would be at the transnational level.
Let me start with...
Just wait for the microphone. I don't mind you intervening, but
I have problems with this whole hegemony idea, the whole construct. Let's put some real examples here. Google. Is that where's the hegemony there? Microsoft. Any form of connectivity that you're talking about here relies on IT. If you're talking about, for example, communities in the Solomon Islands, where I've worked for some time, the only way in which those communities could connect with other NGOs, within their own country, was through IT. Otherwise, you're talking about huge expense. The only way they could get that through was through the United Nations or the World Bank or through OSCE providing money for them. Hegemony?
It seems to me that you're agreeing with Helmut, but maybe you want to respond.
No. You're in a different level. We look at the question not whether Google or Microsoft or some other communication platform, how that relates to counter-hegemony or hegemony. We're looking at the question of NGOs and their relationships in regards to these structural outcomes. So we have a different question. If you then ask to what extent is that exchange or the relationships among NGOs facilitated or obstructed by platforms such as Google, such as Microsoft? That we can't answer that question because we don't have the data on that.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, there's a whole list of questions for Haggai.
Yeah,
so
maybe
Haggai
should
cut
take
it off
that.
Let
me start with the Putnam and Gramsci. In Gramsci's discussion of this historic block, the historic bloc first develops and then adopts a reformist ideology, a counter-hegemonic ideology. There's no place where he says that all of those that all the participants in this sort of block must be anti-capitalist. What can be understood, and maybe it's my own interpretation of Gramsci, is that there is some kind of realignment of ideology in this historic bloc, and therefore not necessarily everybody who is in this network, in this global network of NGOs, has to be reformist. But once this network is elaborate enough, big enough, articulated well enough, well connected, and predominantly reformist, there will be a realignment. Now, this realignment is not guaranteed. There's no, nobody promises us that it will happen. There are various other concerns, various other conditions that will allow for it to emerge, this realignment, this ideological reformist agenda that will engulf the entire network and lead to the emergence of this historic bloc. I haven't looked at those in this study. What I looked at is the structural infrastructure that can allow for this counter-hegemonic bloc to develop. The counter-hegemonic historic bloc has to have a sufficient infrastructure, which is a network such as I mentioned here, that is dense, that is equal, that is well integrated, etc., etc. But it also needs other things, such as this realignment of reformist ideology. The realignment of reformist ideology is the next condition. What I was looking at here is if the first condition, the structural one, is already there. And the answer, as you have seen, not yet. And maybe it won't. We need 10 more years, and that comes back to one of your questions. No, all I had this was 2003. And and the organization that provided the data is not so forthcoming in providing various points of time. I wish they were. I would love to do a longitudinal analysis on that. Let's do incentives. Why should those organizations go global? Let me be naive and say the cause is the incentive. No, they don't have any financial incentives. I can tell you that the World Bank will not be happy to support organizations that will say, we're trying to create a global movement to overturn capitalism. Okay, they won't get money from the World Bank, I can tell you that. Okay? So there are no financial incentives. The incentives are in the cause, the understanding, and that's the job of us as researchers. We need to promote the understanding that to reach a critical mass of global civil society impact in global governance, there needs to be an elaborate network, that the network structure is important. And if those organizations want to have a real impact, want to be a viable counterforce, they need to do that. The question about the different styles of connectivity and the comparison between, or the contrast between Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. Again, we couldn't tell because we don't have the data, but I agree that the different styles of how those organizations connect with local branches or with local NGOs, they're not their own branches, they're not part of this organization, is important. And possibly another factor to take into consideration in the analysis, regretfully, not available unless somebody knows of a foundation that will be happy to give you $100,000 for a continuing study. Yeah.
It's always a good idea to end your pitch with more research needs to be done.
Give me money.
Okay, we're going to squeeze this in the last round of questions, focusing on people who haven't spoken before. So that's you very clearly, and also the lady behind you, and the lady in the pink vest, and you. Yeah.
On your gentleman.
Yeah. It's been neglected.
Thank you very much. I mean, when you're talking about global connectiveness, I honestly want to take the dark side of what you call connectedness, because when we talk, we're currently talking about connectedness while it has started a long time ago. I can date it back from the 15th century with global connectedness through slavery. And secondly, later on, global connectedness through colonization, and global connectedness through what we call recently during the oil crisis about structural adjustment programs. All those issues are global connectedness, and I mean it's sad that it's always seven countries who have always borne the burden of northern countries. And when the situation is reached such a point that, you know, northern countries are unable to cope with it, they just found structures through connectedness, you know, to make southern countries bear the burden of the problem. When we, I'm going to take an example.
No, please don't. We
during
have
the oil
time.
Crisis, during the oil crisis, when we take the proportion of oil consumption, it's obvious that northern countries consume more than southern countries. But as it's just after the oil crisis, structural adjustment program came to being, just to transfer the burden they couldn't bear here to southern countries in order for them to cope with it through pooling the wealth of developing countries. So I'm really concerned in a positive outcome for southern countries for global collectiveness. Thank you.
Thank you. Lady behind you, please also keep it brief.
Thank you, Diana Lead. If we look at the best predictors of connections and collaborations between non-profit organisations within the UK, then that tends to be not in terms of a common mission, which is actually a rather bad predictor, hence the large number of cancer charities, etc. But actually, if there is something in it for you to collaborate and connect, and something in it is very often money, but there is a sort of dual thing going on there. On the one hand, a competitive funding environment discourages connections, because you're trying to establish your brand, etc. And on the other hand, a highly competitive funding environment can also encourage connections. So I was wondering whether your data enable you to look at the basis of the connections between organizations, and to what extent resource dependency, different patterns of funding, and so on, predict connections. If you have, for example, if international foundations, endowed grant-making foundations, why would they collaborate with each other or connect with each other? They don't need to.
Thanks. The gentleman in the Adida shirt.
You seem to identify the hegemon that currently exists as being both structural and ideological, as in North-South and also neoliberalism. But when you're going through your analysis and looking at the networks that you currently had, I didn't understand why a counter-hegemon has to be displaced throughout the entire world, why it couldn't be centrally located in what is currently the structural bias in the North. Isn't it enough that the ideology of all this global civil society is opposite to the current hegemon? Wouldn't that be the counter-hegemon?
Okay, and the lady in pink, and the lady two seats down from there, and then I'd like to close it.
Would you agree that the structure of the dense global INGO connections, which can possibly serve for a counter hegemony, may equally well be a dangerous vehicle to finally entrench neoliberal capitalism, and therefore actually really worrying that that can get to all of the places that so far have been spared?
Actually, I have a very similar question to the one you just had, because I agree with her, and I think that you said that NGOs are delivering services, but isn't that really, a big problem, because it takes away the responsibility of states, and if they're still the main actors in globalization, I think this is very dangerous, because they're acting in this capitalist logic, and so that they're not able to tame neoliberalism, as you said, but they're actually reinforcing this logic.
Okay, so I think we have a whole kind of set of connected questions here to do with the dark side of global connectedness. Is it about the ideology or about the geography? Isn't there something dangerous about connecting? What is the basis for the connectedness and the role of service delivery? Should we start with Helmut again?
If it's okay, Haggai, I will address the first two questions, because the other ones are far more directly to you. About the dark side of connectedness. Let me answer you at two levels very briefly. Of course, we know from network analysis that the interpretation of a network structure is all the richer the more different content you have. So if you look at some connectivity only in terms of a positive element or content, it's not as good as rich for the theory you try to test as if you had plus and minus, so to speak. So I totally agree with you that this is simply, it's not a fault in the logic of the study, it's merely a fault in what is available to us. I disagree with the implications of some of the things you said. We did not study connectivity as a whole, like the connectivity that you have in the business world or the connectivity that you have in other historical areas. That is well beyond what we could achieve or what Haggai could achieve in one study or we in one chapter. We just looked at one element of it in NGOs. But if I now, assuming we had done it, what would have my reaction been? I think that the opposite of connectivity in today's globalized world is dissociation. And your comments reminded me of a debate that we had in the early 80s, the mid-80s, about in a socialist framework that you have to dissociate a national economy from the world economy for it to grow, kind of an indigenous movement. And wherever that happened, I don't think the results were that great. So I don't think it would do Africa or some other parts of the world much good to cut ties to the world economy.
We're not going to have that
debate. Yeah, I know, we shouldn't have that debate. Because I think, oh my God, he's opening a Pandora's box there. Yeah. And I think, if briefly, very to Diana, you hit it right on the spot there. And I slightly disagree with her guide that it's not, the incentive structure should not only be in the mission. There has to be more to it, and I think when you look at the policy implications, particularly for how NGOs become sustainable, there is much, much more that can be done. I think we have to go beyond the conventional funder-recipient model. There has to be much more in terms of a business-to-business relationship among NGOs who have income-generating activities to counteract the severe resource dependencies that we have at the moment.
I think, to continue on that point, data shows that networking and creating diverse networks, not just networks that have very similar actors, contributed greatly to the effectiveness of the projects that NGOs are pursuing. And you can read Sicking and Keck, and you can read Mario Diani's work on social movements. And you can read all the work that was done on Narmada and on the, there are countless examples. So there are many benefits in connecting beyond the cause. And I also argue in my recommendations of what are the next steps is that donors should encourage this. Donors, I think, should have this systemic bird's eye look on global governance issues, on global civil society and its role, and they should create those incentives. Okay? But beyond those incentives, organizations need to understand that they need to act strategically to create those linkages, because those linkages help them achieve their own mission and help them also generate some more general, more wider level change. As to the risk of connectedness, I want to echo what Helmut said about the dangers of the lack of connectedness. Mm-hmm. And one of the main points, and I think one of the stronger speakers for connectedness in the world of human rights is Murray Calder from this school, who says that this enmeshment in this global network and this visibility that is a result of this connectedness allows, let's say, doesn't allow nations anymore to get away with human rights, because they are seen, they can be easily seen. So the lack of connectedness can be even worse. But definitely, connectedness can have a dark side, and a very well articulated network could possibly be taken over by neoliberal ideologists and be used for their own intentions. Although I can't see how a global network of NGOs that is so diverse, so not centralized, can be easily taken over by anybody but themselves. And lastly, the question is, why does this network has to be global? This network has to be global, because if it's not global, it's not fully representative of all those interests. And if it's not fully representative of all those interests, it's not a historic bloc. It's not a counter-hegemonic historic bloc. By virtue of the premise, the main premise of what a counter-hegemonic historic bloc is, that it is all-inclusive, all the subaltern, all of those marginalized groups are part of it. They are connected to it. They may not be very active, but they have access. There is a link that allows them to put their voice in there, to have, to feel belong, that they belong, that they are part of this network, and therefore it has to be global. It can't skip anyone.
Thank you very much, Bertha. I feel like we've only just opened a debate. Rather sorry to close it, but there it is. We can't go on all night. We'll have another lecture in this Global Civil Society series by Richard Falk on the 30th of November in the Old Theatre, which is on global democracy, no less. So I think that offers ample opportunities to reopen some of these questions. Also, Kim Campbell will talk about the Madrid agenda on terrorism in the Hong Kong Theatre here on the 1st of December. Thank you very much, Helmut and Haggai. Thank you very much, audience, for such an attentive and critical engagement.
Thank you.